And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this faith. Tonight we've got some long-term sobriety going to share with us, Mr. Richard. He is an alcoholic, and he's speaking our language. So everybody welcome Richard.
All right. Yeah, I used to fall down a lot. What's that falling down now? I'm Richard English. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Richard.
Okay. I'm not used to a mic. All right. Here we go. You know, I've been thinking about this for some time, and I've told about 30 stories, and I haven't liked any of them. So whatever comes out. I'm not even going to think about it. I am an alcoholic. I was born June 2, 1937. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. I have five brothers and sisters. We moved. My father was with International Cellucod Products, which was a forerunner to Kimberly Clark. So we moved a lot. And my dad used to travel on trains back then. He didn't travel by car. But I remember my first trip with my father, and we were in an overnight sleeper. We were going to Oklahoma, I think, and I remember my father putting me to bed, and I remember his love. I never forgot it. So anyway, we moved a lot, and let's see, we moved Oklahoma, Louisiana, Baton Rouge, New Orleans. We moved five or six times in New Orleans, and my dad had a office in the French quarters in the La Marillion Hotel, and he used to take me down to his office, and I loved to go down there and walk around the French quarters and all that good food smelling and everything, and I loved that. And, of course, I loved being with my father. And, anyway, then my mother suffered from depression. And so it was suggested that we move to a smaller town, get out of New Orleans. And so we moved to Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, a little small town, and I loved it there. And I went to school there, St. Stanislaus, good school, Christian Brothers. And they were very strict. And if you didn't do your assignments, whatever they were, you had to go up to the front of the class. And Brother Arthur, I remember him, I liked him very much. And he'd hit you across the knuckles with a ruler. And sometimes he'd turn it sideways. God, that hurts, you know. So I try to do my homework and not get smacked across the knuckles. And I had my first good fishing experience there. They had a pier, and Dad bought me a rod and reel. And I went out, and I caught four nice speckled trout. The water was real clear, and I could see them swimming, and I threw the bait right in front of them, and they hit. Anyway, they were really nice sized fish. And where the school was, I had to walk back through town. Of course, I had to walk back through town with my fish. And everyone asked me about them. Of course, I had to tell them about my fish. It was a wonderful experience. We moved from Bay St. Louis to Clearwater, Florida. And Dad was made Southeastern sales manager Again, it was still International Cellucot Products. It wasn't Kimberly-Clark then. And we moved to Clearwater, Florida, and I loved Clearwater, Florida. And I played tennis. And, I had a job. I had a job working for this man. He was 60 years old, but to me, he was an old man. And I guess maybe I was 10 or 11 in a summer job. And he'd come by the house right before sunrise and blow the horn, and I'd go out and I'd work with him all day. And he worked on estates and digging up tree trunks and cutting stuff. And I mean, it was hard work. So I tried to keep up with that old guy, and I couldn't keep up with him. I tried my best to keep up with him, but I couldn't. And then he'd take me home at the sun go down, and we'd go home. I'd be so damn tired. Sometimes I wouldn't even eat dinner, and I'd go to bed, and I'd get to sleep real good, and some bitch was out there blowing the horn again. I said, oh, God, I can't. But That was a good. I love that job. I liked doing that. But anyway, so we lived in Clearwater, and we lived there for 4 years, and I loved it. And then we had to move from Clearwater, and I hated that because. And we moved up here. We moved up here in '52, and I started at Marist High School. I went to school there. I bought my uniform, and it lasted me through the whole 4 years at Marist. And I had some great teachers, good teachers, you know. Yeah, it was downtown, and it was where Sacred Heart was. The Marist Fathers owned that land. And I had an English teacher, Father Hagerman, and he was prefect of discipline. And he was a tough old goat, and I didn't like him worth shit. And he taught English, so I tried my damnest to get an A in his class. We had to write a theme every night, 75 or 100 words. And he'd say something like, the bullet went flying past Grandma. He says, now write me 100 words on that, so, or whatever. And I couldn't, I tried. I could, the best I could do, I think, was a B one time. And I really got pissed at him. So I wrote a theme, and it was in between the lines that I was really being very critical of him. And he pulled that out, and he read it to the class. And in between the lines, he read and exactly what I was saying to him. He read it all out, and I said, oh, Jesus. But anyway. We became friends. and he was a wonderful English teacher, and all my teachers there. I had a little Irish teacher that taught algebra, Father Kerwick, and I loved him. He was a little Irish guy, and he'd sit up there and he'd say, "You're all a bunch of jackies. You're all a bunch of jackies," and of course, jackasses, you know. And I didn't really know what that was until I became one. And, of course, I did become one. So, anyhow, I graduated from there, and then I went, I had a short stay at Georgia. And I could see, right, intuitively I knew that I was going to, I had to work hard in school, and I intuitively I knew that this was truly going to interfere with my drinking. So I just decided not to, to go to college, and I got a job somewhere. I forgot where I got a job, but I was drinking that. Now, I wanted to drink like my dad. My dad was a heavy, heavy drinker. He always went to work, though. He never missed work. He always went to work. So that's how I was going to do it. I was going to drink and always go to work. And towards the end, I couldn't work. But anyway, so we rocked along there, and then I got married. Oh Jesus! And twice, and you know, the gals I married, they were beautiful, wonderful, really. They were the, and I was in love with them. I truly was. And I started. My first marriage. Vance says you drink too much. He says I'm not going to marry you. You just have to not drink. And I said all right. So I wouldn't drink. And for 11 months I didn't drink anything. And then we got married. And then I started on the honeymoon with champagne. And we got into a big argument. And it went on from there for 7 years. We had three children. Three beautiful children, and my drinking started getting serious then, and it just got, the drink was more important to me than my wife, than my children, than my job, and of course then I start losing jobs, and Van divorced me, and then I remarried, and the reason... One of the reasons I remarried is this: Nancy had a house. So my plan was I'd get my three children from the first marriage, and she had a house, and I'd bring them in there, and we'd live happily ever after. Well, we had three children, and she was widowed with three children, and we did get... My three children, at one time we had nine children in the house, and it was, wow, it was something. But anyway, here again my drinking's going along. And towards the end here, I start becoming violent, and I did. I went into rages, and Nancy fled with the children because she was afraid I was going to hurt them, and I very well could have hurt the children, and she divorced me, and she did the best thing for me because I was out there now. I didn't have anyone to take care of me, and I was on my own, and that was the best thing she did for me. Because I didn't see, that was in 75. Yeah, 75 is when she threw me out. And I mean, when she threw me out, everything, not even a comb was left in that house that I could go back and say, hey, I forgot my comb. Everything. She put everything out of it. She was rid of me. And I pretty much gave up after that. I said, oh, what the hell? So let's see, that's 75, and then 76, I met my last drinking partner, Joanne, and she had a place out in Marietta, and I moved out there, and my last year of drinking was with Joanne. And God, we drank some liquor. Jesus. And she could outdrink me. This first woman I ever met that could outdrink me. She could sit down and drink a half a gallon of vodka. And it was hard for me to drink a half a gallon of vodka. But by this time, what I could hold was starting to go down. You know, I could drink a half a pint and I'd be wiped out. And I didn't like that because I like to drink. But anyway, towards the end, she came home one day and I was passed out and I came to and she hit me over the head with a steel chair and tried to kill me. She did. And blood running. I said, you tried to kill me. She says, you're goddamn right. You drank my quart of vodka. And I said, no. That was my quart of vodka, and hers was still in the cupboard. And anyway, I thought I'd best move out of there, and I did. And I got my own place, and it was a flop house on Dixie Avenue, and I lived with a bunch of winos there, and I looked down upon the winos because they drank wine and I drank vodka. I thought I was better than them, but what the hell, you know. It was bad. It was bad. And I got to that state where, you know, it was horrible. I was totally alone. I couldn't make contact with anybody, really. I couldn't. I was totally I was totally alone, and I was in terrible pain, and I would think about all the, I didn't have my children, I didn't have nothing, and the miracle happened, and it was a miracle. It happened on September 24th, 1978, and I was sitting there drinking my, I had old Fitzgerald. I don't know why I got old, because I usually drank vodka. And I had drank about half the bottle, and it didn't do a damn thing. It didn't do anything. And I was watching the roaches run around, and some of them were real, and some of them weren't, you know. And Joanne came by, and she knocked on the door, and she was shaking bad. She really needed a drink, and I knew that she did need a drink. And she says, "I'm going to an AA meeting. Do you want to go?" And I said, yes. I thought I could help her. I don't know what I was... I had compassion for her. I really did. And I thought maybe I could help her. I don't know what I was going to do to help her, but I followed her. And I followed her into AA, and that's how I got to AA, following my former drinking partner into the program. And so we... I picked up a white chip, and I didn't know what it was all about, and they all clapped, and I thought everyone was crazy there. I said, what the hell are they clapping about? I don't know why they're clapping, but they did, and I picked up that white chip, and Joanne picked up a white chip, and we got back together, moved out to the lake or somewhere, I don't know, and we've gone to meetings, and I got a little pissy ant job. I was still, after 3 months, she picked up the drink, and I fled. I did. I fled. And I moved out to Tucker. I got a job working in an office supply place. I got a job working in a warehouse. I was shot when I got to this program. I couldn't. Hell, I couldn't watch television, read a paper, nothing. I was just... And I got a job, and I'd get lost going to work. I would. I forgot how to get to work. But I got a job, and it was perfect for me because it was working in a warehouse. And I'd go there in the morning, and I'd work hard all day in a warehouse. And I'd come home at night, and I'd be tired. And sometimes if I could make it to a meeting, I would. And sometimes I wouldn't, but that's what I did. And that's how I started off in the program. And I was going to Clarkston. I started out, I came from Rebus to Clarkston. And then I kept hearing about the Biscayne Room. And so I thought, well, I'll go over to the Biscayne Room and find out what that's about. And there was this dragon lady sitting on a sofa. And she had a bunch of people around her. And I just wanted to tease her. I really did. So I went over and I stepped on her, kind of lightly stepped on her foot, and she jumped up and stomped my foot. She said, "God damn it, don't you step on my foot." And I said, "Huh. I liked her right away." And we became friends. We did. We became friends. And lovely, lovely lady. I was with Maggie for almost 20 years. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and she told me to read this pamphlet on sponsorship, and which I never did. And I tell other people, I said, you know, I'll read that book on sponsorship. It's good. But it is a good book to read, especially for, and I became her wheel man, and I drove her everywhere. Now, the reason I became her wheel man, and a lot of people said, "Oh, isn't Richard nice? He's driving Maggie around." which was bullshit. I rode with her one time, and she was the worst driver you would ever want to see. She scared the shit out of me in a car. I mean, she was horrible. It was a wonder that she had lived as long as she did. So I decided that I would drive her, and out of self-protection of myself, and that's how I got came to drive Maggie around, and we drove all over. I had the best time with that cow, golly. And Maggie loved the drunk. She truly loved the drunk. I was at the Biscayne Room then, and in the golden years, we had a recovery room there, and we take you in for 3 days, and keep you for 3 days, and give you orange juice, and we'd sit with you while you detoxed, and it took 3 days to detox, and boy, we got some Lulus. Now Kerbo, Mike Kerbo here, he used to send drunks over there, and he would send the worst drunks you'd ever want to see. God, they were horrible. I mean, they were. But anyway, one came in one day, and I said, "Well, did Mike send you?" And he says, "Yeah, how did you know?" I says, I can tell. But it was, it was a wonderful experience sitting with drunks, and a lot of them went into convulsions because, you know, you're drinking and you, all of a sudden you stop drinking, something's going to happen, and it usually did. But we would call 911, and they were right down the street, and they'd come and take them to the hospital. I had one guy come in, and he had to go to the hospital. And the next day he came back, and he wanted to continue his recovery there. And I said, "Sure, Mike Patterson." I think he's still sober today. Anyway, we had a great time. And of course, the reason I'm dressed up like this is because one time I went with Maggie to Clarkston, and a priest, I won't mention his name, he was the guest speaker. And he came out there, and he needed a shave, and his shoes were all scuffy, and his pants were wrinkled, and Maggie just cussed his ass out. She says, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. You look like a bum." This was a priest, too. So I dressed up for you, Maggie. Anyway, another time, Maggie was a friend of Hillary in Cullman, Alabama. And he was a abbot there, Benedict. And Rome used to send priests to him. And Maggie would go out to the airport and make sure that when they got off the plane from Alabama, this doesn't have anything to do with recovery, but anyway, I have to tell these little stories. They get off the plane and then go on to Birmingham, and Maggie would make sure they got on the right plane, you know. So we go out there one day, and this Monsignor gets off the plane, and he's drunk as a three-eyed goat, and Maggie just cusses. She says, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself, a man of the cloth, drunk like that, you know." And he was a little Irish priest. He says, "Ah, Maggie," he says, "it was the brandy that did me in." So, but he went on to Coleman, and Father Hillary worked with him. And I asked him years later if he ever recovered, and he said, "No, he died from the drink. He didn't recover. Some of us recover, some of us die." And I want to touch on something else. In the program, we had, as goes on everywhere, he and she, you know, and we had this real good-looking gal come in. And we had this one guy that he was hitting on all the gals. So I went to him and I said, "Now you stay away from her." And then I went to him and I told him to stay away from her. All right. So then I went to her and I told her that I talked to so and so, and we've told him to stay away from you. And you know what she said to me? She says, "That's none of your goddamn business." And you know, she was absolutely right. It's none of my damn business if they're he-ing and she-ing or he-ing and he-ing and she-ing and she-ing. It's none of my goddamn business. It isn't. It's none of my business. That's true. I had to say that because they were talking about predators here at the other meeting. And it wasn't too long ago that Debbie and I gave a gal a ride to the hotel up here, and she was a hooker. And she was coming here getting phone numbers, and, you know, so, but anyway. That's true.
That's working the program.
Yeah, that's working the program. And anyway, I was supposed to talk about the steps, and my experience with the first step was, you know, we say we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And I didn't quite understand that. And they read it on the board up there and powerless over, I don't know what the hell does that mean, you know. But I didn't drink. One of the things I did when I first got here is I didn't drink. I thought for myself that I was only going to get one shot at this. That was for me. Now, this is what I felt and thought. And that's the way it worked for me. I wasn't going to get a second shot at this. So I was really terrified to drink. And I go to meetings and I try to listen and I didn't understand anything. It wasn't until I started experiencing the steps and the first step that I experienced, and I was in the program for 3 years, not drinking, and I went to Chicago to visit with my mother for Christmas. Oh, I got to tell you about this. And it was my first Christmas with mother, and I was sober, and it was just mother and I, and we decorated the Christmas tree the old-fashioned way. Mother had candles, real candles, and we put candles on the tree and decorated it, put popcorn on it, everything. And she invited some little kids to come by, and they looked at it, and this little kid said, "I've never seen a Christmas tree like that." Well, I hadn't either, really. But this was from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I completely accepted my mother, not the way I always wanted her to be. I always wanted my mother to be this or that, or she didn't do the little. I just accepted her the way she was, and we had the most beautiful Christmas, and it was just wonderful, and I'll never forget that. But that came from the program, and we talk about acceptance, and it's first I had a, but anyway, so. I'm on this plane, and they're serving the drinks, and I'm watching. We're leaving Atlanta, and this man, he takes this drink, and he picks it up, takes a sip, and puts it down. And he left that sitting there from Atlanta to Chicago. And I kept looking at it, and I kept saying, "Pick the goddamn thing up and drink it," you see. That's when I got it, because I never, ever did that. Once I put booze in me, that was it. I couldn't stop. See, I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop. I just kept drinking. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that till I experienced that on the plane going to Chicago and having not drank for almost 3 years, that I finally got it down gut level that it's the first drink. Did it every time, and I never ever had a sip of anything without just going all the way with it. So I understood that. And then the second step for me was I'd been in the program for a while, and I thought, well, I hadn't had a drink for a while. And I thought about that. And I said, this is good. I haven't had a drink for a while. But the miracle for me was I didn't want to drink. That was the first time I didn't want to drink. And that's when I realized, and I knew exactly where that came from. I knew exactly where that came from. And that's when I came to believe. I really did come to believe then. And the third step, I've had a lot of experiences on the third step. I've been fortunate to to have sponsees and go out to the monastery and we do the third step. And I think, though, the third step, the experience I felt on the third step was, and I don't know how long I'd been in the program, but everything was going to hell in a handbasket, and I felt like shit. I wasn't drinking. It's just I was just down. And I was praying. I was praying there. I was praying. I said, you know, Jesus. And all of a sudden, I felt love. I never really had felt that before. And it just kept coming. I said, wait a minute, Lord, I can't take any more of this. I'm going to blow up. You know? But that's what I felt. And, of course, the fourth step, who in the hell wanted to do the fourth step? And the reason, I think the only reason I did the fourth step is because the class was getting ahead of me, and they were all talking about the fourth step, and I hadn't done the fourth step. So I thought, well, hell, I better do the fourth step. So I did the fourth step, and I wrote it all down. And then I carried it around for about a year in the back of my car, and I was afraid someone was going to find it and read it. You know, what the hell? But then I finally shared it with a man that looked like he wasn't going to live too much longer. And he was in a wheelchair. He was in a wheelchair. And he had cancer and emphysema, and God, he was... And so I said, well, I'll tell him, and he can go on with it. And I told him, and he lived for another 3 years, so it didn't really matter who knew it on the fifth. And the sixth and seventh step, I don't know. And I hear people talking about peeling the onion and all that bullshit, and I've never understood that either. So, I still probably got more than I had when I came in, because now I know of them. Before I didn't know of them, but now I know I'm aware of them. Anyway, I'm aware of them, and that's good. And maybe I can work on them, and maybe I can. It depends on how bad they get. And if they get too bad, then I'll try to do something. Now the eighth step, I was not going to put my first ex-wife's name on it. I just wasn't going to do it. And I didn't. I never did. I never did put her name on it. There was a lot of names I didn't put down on it. But she particularly, I was not going to put her name on it. And I didn't. But further down the line, that took care of itself. And the ninth step, and that's direct amends, and that's when I took care of the first ex-wife, and it just happened, and we were sitting there, and I looked her right in the eyes, and I told her I was terribly, terribly sorry for the harm I caused her when we were married, and I was. And I asked her to forgive me. And I don't know whether she did or didn't, but I did what I did, and I was finally free of the bitch. Anyhow. She still don't like me, but that's all. We had three children, too, and they're beautiful children. But anyway, that's all right. I like her all right. As much as I can, you know. My second ex-wife was the most beautiful woman, most loving, caring woman you'd ever want, and she still is. And when we talked to each other on the phone, I say I love you, and she says she loves me. And we had three children, and she did what she had to do because she was fearful for the children, and I might have harmed one of them. Some of the things that I did in the past paid off later on. For instance, Jaws. There was a time when she was in a car, and she locked herself in a car, and if I could have got my hands on her, I'd have killed her. And there's no doubt in my mind that I would have killed her. Now, I was fortunate enough to do an AA meeting at Georgia Regional Hospital for a couple of years. A couple of those guys out there had, in fact, killed their wives and girlfriends. I understood them perfectly. And they were in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we used to have some of the best meetings there. I took a sponsee out there, and we'd go out there. And some of them still come here to meetings. But I understood them completely. I belong also to another group, and we work with folks with various forms of mental illnesses, and I have one, and alcoholism is a form of mental illness. But we say something in there that we see the person and not the illness. We see the person and not the illness. And that's what we do here. We see the person and not the illness. The illness is there. It's part of the person, but it's not the whole person. And that's what we try to do, or I try to do in the fellowship and trying to work the steps and in the program. It's the person. And every person that's in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful, beautiful person. But some of us, and sometimes myself, we don't know that about ourselves. But we find that out about ourselves by trying to work the program and experience the principles of the program. Oh, I want to say I've got to put a plug in for my home group. I've got the how's my time doing? Well, I'm doing pretty good. My home group is, I went to the Biscayne Room for about 20 years, and I had a bitter break with them, and it was all about money. And Maggie and I and some other folks had raised about $125,000, and the group that was running the room then, we couldn't get them to spend it. It was supposed to be spent on the room, so I got a hold of Maggie one day, and I says, come on, Maggie, let's go down to the bank. And we went down to the bank, and we had everything signed over to our names. And I went to, I called Clyde Nix up, and I says, come and put some windows in there. We're just going to start spending the money, fix the room up, you see. And, of course, the board, they found out about it. Oh, geez, all hell broke loose then. And it did, and we went to court, and it was a big mess. But all we really wanted to do, I knew Maggie was not going to last too much longer, and wanted to fix the place up, and that's all I wanted to do. I was over there recently. I went over there and picked up my 30-year chip, and the room is beautiful. They finally fixed it up. They finally spent some money. It really is beautiful. And I saw a friend of mine over there, and he was working with another drunk. And so it's great. It's good. There are people there, and they're working with drunks, and they're working the program, and it's really great. I was glad to see that. I was really so happy to see that. So, but anyway, my home group is the early morning study group, and I started coming to the early morning study group about 10 years ago, and I've been coming there, and it's one of the best groups of folks. They really are. I had a couple of years ago, I had a triple bypass, and they all came to see me. They all came to the hospital to see me, and I've told people this. It was the happiest 2 weeks of my life. It really was. I mean, people came in to see me, and I just felt great. And they told me, when I told folks I was going to have a triple bypass, and folks said, well, I'm going to pray for you. And I said, hell, don't pray for me. Pray for my doctors. And they did, and they did a good job on me. They did a real good job on me. They fixed me up real good. I can't really tell you the love I felt when I was in the hospital from the folks that come here. It was just God. It was really good. So I recently turned, last year I turned 70 and had a big party. And I was in the pool with 8 of my 9 grandchildren. My son's got a big place. He's made a lot of money. And last year he said, we went to Thanksgiving there last year, and he says, his wife said, he's, you know, we're taking $25 to kind of pay for the roast and stuff like that. I thought, Jesus Christ. But anyway, I paid him $25. He's only making $150,000 a year, and I didn't pay for that. I was going to invite him over to my house this Thanksgiving, but I said, to hell with it. I'm not even going to invite him over. But that's not working the program, I know. But what the hell, you know, we're not saints. It says that we're not saints. So that's good. And we had this party, and let's see, my two ex-wives were there, and my present wife was there, and eight of my nine, and most of my children were there. I have nine children, three by the first, three by the second, and three stepchildren, or I call them my children. And so we had a great time, and it was just really neat. And my wife announced on my 70th birthday that I had great potential. She says, I have great potential. Oh, good. Okay. So, and I got to tell you about my wife, Debbie. And some of you know Debbie. And she's the most beautiful, wonderful person a fellow would ever want to know or meet. And she didn't come tonight because she's heard my story more than once. She didn't want to hear it again. Or bits and pieces of it. But the way where I met Debbie was about 15 years ago. She came to the Biscayne Room. She recovered in the Biscayne Room. Anyway, she was going to Peachtree Parkwood. It was a mental hospital there. And I'd go see her every day at 6 o'clock. I'd go visit her. And she'd always have me a cup of coffee. Always have me a cup of coffee when I'd go see her. And I went to see her one day, and she's standing in the day room there, and she's crying. I says, Debbie, what are you crying about? She says, they won't let me fix you a cup of coffee. She got me right there. And so wasn't my fault. And so we got married, and we've been happily married ever since. And she's a wonderful wife, and I'm very fortunate to have her. Debbie has a lot of physical problems too, but we're plugging along and doing okay with it. Let's see. 9 years ago, Debbie had 11 years of sobriety. And and she picked up the drink. Now I've never picked up the drink myself, but I saw it through Debbie, and it was a nightmare. It was truly a nightmare. Debbie's coming up on 9 years now, but when she picked up that drink, I thought I lost her. I really did. I thought I lost her to the drink, and. I was sitting over at the Biscayne Room, and I really didn't know what to do. And I don't know if any of you know Fred Cameron. You remember Fred? And Fred was a grouchy old bastard. We used to growl at each other all the time, and I'd see him, I'd growl, and he'd growl back. But he came over to me, and he didn't say a word to me. He just came over to me, gave me a hug, turned around, walked away. Didn't say a word. And that was Fred. I got to pay him back right before he checked out. He came over here to a meeting, and I just went up to him, gave him a hug, turned around, walked away. Didn't say a word. So he was a pretty neat guy. But anyway, I saw that. I went over to Maggie, and I says, Maggie, I don't know what the hell to do. And Maggie said to me, she says, you got enough sobriety under your belt to get through this. And I did. I didn't think at the time that I did. But I did. And if you'll stop and think about it, all of you have gone through some difficult times, and you had enough sobriety under your belt to get through whatever it was you got through, and you got through it, and you didn't pick up the drink. And that's the beauty of this program. And I've talked long enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. You do have potential, that's for sure.
On that broad highway.